I'm going to share with you a little bit of my political conversion from the home of my birth all the way to the other end of the spectrum and then back to the middle. My parents, at least in the 80s, were reflexively Democratic. They voted for Mondale. I think they were one of the three families in the world, in the country, who voted for Mondale. And they had nothing good to say about Reagan, not even that he ended the Cold War, which I only found out later. So they would never have admitted anything positive about Ronald Reagan. And then I was 19, and as many 19-year-olds do, I read Ayn Rand, which drove me to an extreme other direction of libertarianism, extreme hyperactive libertarianism in the case of Ayn Rand, and just really an excuse to be a selfish, narcissistic 19-year-old. I don't know if I was really following her philosophy or just using it. And then I had a very significant conversation with one of my best friend's fathers during college. You know, I'd taken libertarianism to the degree that I could proclaim that even prostitution should be legal. And he said, "Alon, there are no such things as victimless crimes." And I think I've said this before. I think now we've come to such a chaos of rights without responsibilities that we're entering a period of almost lawlessness, extreme narcissism. So Thomas Friedman wrote an article this week called America 2022, where everyone has rights and no one has responsibilities. Noting that it's certainly within Joe Rogan and Spotify's rights to maintain his contract and to keep up his music, but it's a shameful abnegation of responsibilities. In a less serious example, I haven't played soccer in about 2 years, but I'm about to rejoin my league. And I was always bothered when people would wear earrings during a game. It was against the league rules, but it wasn't very well enforced. And my thought process was, yes, it's your ear, but how do you think I'll feel if I check you and harm your ear irreparably? I'll have to carry that for the rest of my life, that I ruined someone's ear. A small matter, but we've forgotten how to think about the way our decisions affect other people, whether it's with regard to masks and vaccinations, wearing earrings, smoking in public places, fighting with maitre d's. It's really a concern, and it is tearing our country apart for a lot of reasons. So I want to talk today, I think, unsurprisingly, about the humility required to make that kind of society work. And the ways in which humility is not thinking less of ourselves, but thinking of ourselves less. I'll start from the other end, though. As I mentioned during the Torah reading, a lot of this parsha is about pretty clothes. The Leviathan, who wrote in 16th century Italy and talked, in quoting Maimonides, noted that one of the reasons the high priest had these incredibly elaborate garments, beautiful linen clothes, golden thread, incredible ornamented breastplate, was that although his work was mostly internal and required lechavod utifaret, honor and glory internally, not everyone could see internal honor and looked towards the external beauty. And therefore, the text says when Aaron would wear it while officiating, people would listen. They needed a symbolic marker of beauty and glory and extravagance. I don't think that's very flattering to the people, but it is a human trait that we look at the external, we look at the inflated, we look at the elaborate and the embroidered, more than we look at the authenticity within. And you see this also in the description of the golden bells and pomegranates that adorn the bottom of his garments. The Panim Yekarim, who is Shimon Bezalel Neumann, probably a couple of centuries ago, talked about how wealth is used, but it really doesn't matter unless it's accompanied by mitzvot, like a pomegranate. A pomegranate being the symbol of the 613 mitzvot. I don't know if you've ever done it, but I know someone who's counted the seeds of a pomegranate. It's not 613, but it's close. So more than the external, more than what you present, more than the arrogance, more than the narcissistic, what matters is what's on the inside. And Moses, the most humble of all men, says our tradition, what does that humility mean? Because he shows a lot of rage, he shows a lot of inflation. But why does the Torah call him more than once the most anav b'kol adam, the humblest of all men? Maybe Torah didn't understand humility in the same way we do. But how did Torah understand humility? So in this week's parasha and elsewhere, Moses is the one who does the investiture of his brother Aaron and the priests. There's just not enough hands to spare, so it has to come from someone in the senior leadership to give the priests their due. So you can wonder, says Al-Sheikh, Moses Al-Sheikh in the 16th century, imagine Moses' feeling. He must have been so disappointed. He's the one who pictured the temple, but he didn't get to build it. Bezalel and Oholiab did. And he's the one who understood the mitzvot, the laws of officiation in the temple, but it's Aaron and his children who get to do it. He gave up the priesthood. He gave up sanctity. He gave up the public roles to be a true leader. In the words of certain leadership schools, mostly Christian ones, the idea of servant leadership. That leadership is a kind of giving up. And that sometimes true joy comes from sacrifice. And sometimes the best choices you can make to improve your health are giving up certain things, whether it's chocolate or alcohol or running excessively or gambling. That the best choices we make are sometimes the choices to refrain from. You see that, interestingly, one of the most common comments about Parshat Tetzaveh is it's one of the few places since Moses' birth and until his death where you won't hear his name at all. It talks about commanding the people, but it's never given the referent, the pronoun referent, or the subject referent of who does that. As if, metaphorically, Moses absents himself. In the same way that he gives away the priesthood to have a different kind of leadership, he absents himself to make space for others. We call that tzimtzum, retracting, drawing in the divine life. That's how God made creation. This incredible metaphor, this incredible idiom, what it means to fill someone with leadership, the word we use for investiture in the parsha, to make a priest in the same way that we make a cantor or a rabbi. We don't use this phrase as much now, but the idiom was mileta et edam, you fill up their hands. Usually translated in a time and elsewhere, just as investing them with authority. And we call that a dead metaphor because we don't fill anyone's hands, right? You probably have never seen it outside of, say, the crown when Queen Elizabeth is anointed and made queen. So Rashi had to explain it to us because I think the metaphor was starting to fail even in his generations, that they didn't recognize, the common people or the common Jew wouldn't have recognized this effort, this image and idiom of filling one's hands. So he said that the word in Old French was gant, in modern French, a leather glove, oh, that's modern French, but he gives the Old French word, and the ruler would put in your hand a leather glove. You can picture the scene of calling someone to duel by slapping them with the glove, right? So the ruler would hand you the glove, the gauntlet of the work, granting you authority, giving up some part of his self to make you official, to give you the strength. There's such a power in humility and giving up and letting go. Cliff Tennyson, a therapist in town, talked about the way that humility across a power differential can build trust. That's what Moses does, ceding some of his self, ceding some of his authority given by God, ceding some of his own personality to make himself smaller, to make himself awkward of speech, to give up certain roles to others, as Yitro initiated but continues throughout the parsha, to make himself not all things to all people, but to recognize the role of others in his life, in the life of the community, in the strength of a healthy community. We avoid that at our own peril. And we start to think, it's my right. I don't have any responsibility to my neighbor. And that's never been a successful formula for communities. And Ayn Rand, libertarians, John Locke, the Western tradition of rights without responsibilities or rights prior to responsibilities is in stark contrast to the Jewish tradition that doesn't, as I've said, care much about rights or autonomy. And I want to put that paradox in your mind. I don't want to speak exclusively for one tradition or the other. Still in my heart, I'm a free market capitalist in a lot of ways. Still in my heart, I'm a believer in civil rights, in negative and to an extent positive rights, to use the philosophical terminology. But more and more, I recognize the grievous loss to a society when we forget about responsibilities. So on that breastplate, there were 12 stones, and Shush can tell you more about them. And each of them represented one of the names of the sons of Israel, one of the tribes, in the order of their birth. And that when Aaron would go officiate, or the future priest, the future high priest would officiate, it was as if they carried the names of all the people with them. They had to carry the community in their minds and hearts and spirits. And I can tell you, in many spiritual practices, Jewish, Buddhist, 12-step, Quaker, psychotherapeutic, that service to others is a kind of liberation. That service to others, recognizing others' needs, is incredibly fulfilling. Not just because we feel good when people thank us for our altruism, because it takes us out of our own selfishness and own self-awareness and into a mindful space of being connected. That's what those lapis stones are about. That's what Moses is giving up is about. That's what the idea of having mitzvot rather than just external inflated appearances is about. That's how you understand holiness. That's how you understand spirituality. It's only in that place of giving up and in that place of remembering others that you can encounter holiness. Chapter 29, verse 22 uses the word evada. God there in the sanctuary, in the tabernacle, in the holiest of holies will make God's self known to us. It's only through a kind of renunciation, not a monastic renunciation, not a Catholic priestly renunciation, not a Buddhist renunciation, but a renunciation of self-concern, self-aggrandizement, and certainly narcissism, that we can find true happiness, that we can build a society worth its salt, and that we can find joy of a life well lived.